Hello and welcome to another edition of Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs magazine brought to you by DW, Germany's international broadcaster. On today's programme, intrigue and betrayal in the German Green Party. Europe reacts to Trump.
European companies employ in the United States 3.5 million Americans. And another million American jobs depend directly on trade with you. Of all American assets abroad, two-thirds are in Europe. And the US provides over 50% of our LNG.
And President Erdogan's delicate balancing act. That's all coming up with me, Kate Laycock, here on Inside Europe. With history unfolding at breakneck speed across the Atlantic, it is, I have to admit, with something akin to relief that I'm going to start the programme with a good old-fashioned tale of political intrigue. The story centres around a rather unlikely candidate for scandal, the German Green Party, currently part of the bad-tempered and outgoing government coalition. Now, normally, for a story like this, I would be ringing up our political correspondent Thomas Barrow in Berlin. But this week, I didn't have to do that because look who I just bumped into in the foyer here in Bonn.
Yes, I'm here in Bonn. What a great time to be talking to you, and also a great topic. Political intrigue is always something that we like to talk about.
Right, okay. So lay it out for me, Thomas. Political scandal, intrigue, backstabbing. What's been going on?
We're talking here about Stefan Gelbhaar, who's an MP from Berlin. He's been in the parliament for a few years, and he was actually announced as the candidate for that district in Berlin for Pankow until something very strange happened. He was confronted with allegations of harassment, which he denied and denies. And what happened in the last few days, in the last few weeks, in the beginning of the year, is that at least part of those allegations have been found to be fabricated, apparently by someone who was also a member of the party. So the question that many media are asking is this really a political intrigue within the party? What is actually happening inside the Greens?
Right, okay. Because when you say fabricated, right, what we're talking about here is somebody who had quite a high profile within the local political party of the Greens, who went to the trouble of creating a complete alter ego, like she was going under a different name, in order to lodge very serious allegations against a fellow member of her own party.
That's the case. So Stefan Gelbhaar has denied any wrongdoing. Other women have indeed upheld their accusations against Stefan Gelbhaar, and the Greens are investigating the matter. They're saying that they're investigating the matter very seriously and they want to get to the bottom of it and understand what really happened. But part of those allegations were really described as being fabricated, and one of the local media outlets in Berlin, RBB, which is the public broadcaster in Berlin, had to actually also apologise for part of their reporting because they took that statement from the person and didn't review it to the extent that they then found that it was fabricated. It's a huge story. It has really put Robert Habeck into a sort of defensive position where he has faced questions from the press about this and what it will mean for the Green Party and what it... He would like to focus on the economy. He would like to focus on climate change. He would like to focus on his political aspirations, and instead, what many outlets are actually discussing now is what this all means for the Greens if you have this scandal that began in Berlin.
Do you know what? I even have a prop, actually. I had a bit of an accident on the way. My drink sort of spilt everywhere, so it's a bit soggy, but here's the prop. Here it is. This came through my door a few weeks ago. Can you see what it is?
Well, it's Robert Habeck, who's the main candidate for the Greens.
All right. It's a green election leaflet. And on the front, you have Robert Habeck. I mean, he is the candidate for Chancellor for the Green Party. So, all right, fair enough. But then the message, right? It's ein Mensch, ein Wort. So, you know, one person, one promise kind of thing. And I mean, when I really did a double take when this came through the door, because the extent to which the Green Party have been pinning their campaign on personality politics, you know, like they're on the one hand, you've got a party that's sort of about connectivity and about environmentalism and all the rest of it. But actually, when you look at the campaign that they obviously have been advised is going to do them well, it's very much focused on particular personalities, and particularly the personality of Robert Habeck himself, which seemed like a big risk because he is somebody who, A, has been the subject for a very long time now of a concerted campaign, just article after article after article, really attacking him personally. And B, one man, one promise. Well, hang on, you were a very key figure in the government that has collapsed precisely because it was unable to keep any of the promises that it made in the perception of the public. So, I mean, what, just explain to me what on earth the Greens are being advised. What are they thinking? What's going on?
So a bit of background to this is that the Greens are really facing a very big crisis, irrespective of the current situation with Stefan Gelbhaar. They had very bad results in regional elections last year, in the European elections as well. That led to the party leadership to resign. The party leadership of the Greens is not Robert Habeck or Annalena Baerbock. They have a party leadership which is separate to that. And the new party leadership, at least one of the members of the new party leadership, is said to be very close to Robert Habeck. And indeed, their campaign has now focused specifically on the person of Robert Habeck, that Spitzenkandidat, that Kanzler candidate for the Greens. And in fact, Robert Habeck was not only, or is still, the economy minister, but it's also the vice chancellor. That's one possibility of looking at the story. Like, it's very risky putting all your eggs in the one basket, and that basket being someone who, as you say, has been very criticized. The other side of the story would be that the economy in Germany is the biggest topic now. And you have a chance if the person who is leading the party and who is leading the campaign is someone who is in a position to talk very clearly about what can change, because simply he is the economy minister. So he should be in a capacity to really say, look, the way in which Germany can go forward from a green perspective is this and this and this and this and that. So they see it as an opportunity. The critics see it as a very potentially dangerous risk.
Do you think that the Green Party is particularly susceptible to personality politics because of sort of the campaigning nature of its sort of origins? Or do you think that perhaps German politics more broadly has a sort of a structural tilt towards personality politics? And I'm thinking of the list system. So basically, under the German system, how does it work? Oh my goodness, explain the lists to me.
Basically, if there's the direct mandate, if someone wins the district, but then each party has a list with a number, with say numbers from one to I don't know how many, with the candidates, and depending on how many votes they get in the second vote, in the party vote, then the party gets a number of seats in parliament, and depending on those number of seats, then you begin to count from, say, if they get 20 seats, you count from 1 to 20 in the different lists, and that you have the 20 politicians who end up in parliament.
Right.
So there's a two-system way. Someone who gets into parliament directly by winning a district, and someone who gets into parliament indirectly by being part of a list.
So there's this kind of prestige thing going on, that if I have a direct mandate because I've been so popular locally that I've been returned so resoundingly that my place is completely guaranteed, irrespective of where the party puts me. You know, the party might have put me very, very low on the list, but because of my personal sort of popularity base, I can get straight in there, right? So but then also you have the kind of the prestige within the party of the placings on this list, you know, who is considered an important enough an asset to be able to get a high placing on the list. Like, there's a lot of ego at work, right, in the system.
Absolutely. And you can also end up entering the parliament as a party if you have a certain number of direct winners, let's say, of direct mandaten. So even if the party as such in the second vote does not get above the 5% threshold, you can end up still entering the parliament if, let's say, two or three or four of your candidates win districts directly.
The party that comes to mind here is Die Linke.
Correct.
Who have a history of having very, very strong local support in concentrated areas, but always sort of hovering around that 5% threshold.
Yes. So one thing is the direct mandate, which essentially means this district is CDU territory, or this district is Green territory, or this district is AfD territory. Another thing is how relevant a party or how popular a party might be overall. So depending on the share of votes, is it the SPD, the party that maybe in one region in Germany is particularly strong or not, or the CDU or the Greens or the AfD or the Left party or so on?
Which is so interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, if I imagine that I'm a sort of, you know, a behind the scenes sort of party wonk doing strategy and stuff, then it's going to be totally in my interest to try and build up the local sort of personality cults almost, you know, the local sort of popularity and sort of mythology of particularly charismatic people. But then is that necessarily good for party discipline? Is it necessarily good for a productive working environment when what you're doing is, in effect, having to build people up as individuals when really what you're trying to do is build the party up?
I think it's about striking a balance between the two. Strong personalities, and you need those strong personalities, and they have become stronger in recent years, I would say. And on the other hand, parties that still need to have that party discipline, that still need to make sure that at the end it works also for the party. And that's also why this Gelbhaar scandal could be problematic, to come back to the beginning of our conversation. It's Robert Habeck, the Chancellor candidate, and the Greens facing this scandal in Berlin.
Thomas, to the point as always. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute delight having you in the studio. Would you like another Nussecker? I brought snacks. I'm treating him well.
She is treating me well. Yeah, I'll take a Nussecker. Thank you very much.
DW's political correspondent, Thomas Sparrow there.
Instead of taxing our citizens to enrich other countries, we will tariff and tax foreign countries to enrich our citizens.
Yes, we have to talk about Donald Trump, because as that clip just made clear, the new political course in the USA is going to have major repercussions for countries around the world, and Europe is by no means an exception. From Brussels, Terry Schultz has been watching European leaders' reactions, and, well, let's just say the signals are mixed.
He didn't implement them on his first day in office, but U.S. President Donald Trump wasted no time once back in the White House re-threatening import tariffs on European Union goods.
The European Union is very, very bad to us. They treat us very, very badly. They don't take our cars at all. They don't take our farm products, essentially. They're going to be in for tariffs. It's the only way you're going to get fairness. You can't get fairness unless you do that.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen was the first EU leader to have a major speaking engagement after Trump's January 20th inauguration. Taking the stage at the annual World Economic Forum in Davos, von der Leyen followed a two-track approach based on what's already known about Trump's interests and values. First, she tried to reason with him that a good trade relationship with the EU is essential for the U.S. economy.
European companies employ in the United States 3.5 million Americans, and another million American jobs depend directly on trade with Europe. Of all American assets abroad, two-thirds are in Europe, and the U.S. provides over 50% of our LNG. The trade volume between us is 1.5 trillion euros, representing 30% of global trade. A lot is at stake for both sides.
But von der Leyen followed that up with an implicit threat that if Trump's America turns away from its European partners, the EU will look for additional business ventures, including with his nemesis.
It is time to pursue a more balanced relationship with China in a spirit of fairness and reciprocity. This new engagement with countries across the world is not only an economic necessity, but it's a message to the world. It is Europe's response to rising global competition.
But it's not just trade that's troubling Europeans in these first days of the Trump administration. There's also a lot of discomfort with the power the president has given to Elon Musk, whose X platform is under investigation for breaking EU rules, and who disturbed many people all over the world by giving what appeared to be a Nazi salute at inauguration festivities. The European Parliament held a fractious debate about the new relationship, including this tense exchange between center-left Spanish MEP Laura Ballarin Cereza and Dutch center-right Sander Smit.
To Musk, Zuckerberg and company, in Europe we have a market of millions of users that provide money to your companies, yes, but we also love protecting our citizens and democracies by making laws. If you don't like it, you can always take your Nazi salutes and your masculine energy and go back home.
Protection against defamation is also one of the rights we have to protect in this house. So I would like you to distance yourself from your accusation that Mr. Musk made a Nazi salute. Let's wait. We await his explanation first before these left-wing groups make false accusations against a member of the U.S. government.
After the debate, German MEP David McAllister sought calm, common ground.
The United States is and remains our most important NATO ally and our biggest trading partner. This means, if we want or not, we need to proactively explore common interest with the new Trump administration, even when our priorities don't always align. And indeed, our positions differ on important issues, sadly. We need to prepare responses. We are not alone here in Europe in our concerns about the next 4 years. We must rally our like-minded partners to minimize disruptions and adopt a coordinated approach. If there is any time for us as European Union to act swiftly, it is now, and unity is key. Remaining transatlantic and becoming more European will be the way forward.
Along those same lines, the European Donald, Polish Prime Minister Tusk, was also in the Parliament's Strasbourg plenary to lay out plans for his country's six-month presidency of the Council of the EU. And he evoked the words of the Polish Pope, John Paul II, delivered during the fall of communism. "Be not afraid," Tusk echoed to EU lawmakers.
"It is all dependent on what will happen in our hearts, in our heads. It's all up to us. The future is in our hands, not in the hands of the Chinese or the American people."
That message got a standing ovation. But it's already clear from Trump's first week in office that lawmakers will have to be taking a stand for Europe on many difficult issues in the 4 years that lie ahead. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
You know that old feminist slogan, the personal is political? Well, I kind of feel that in the era of President Trump, that should read, the political is personal. We'll be hearing from Turkey next. That's here on Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock, in Germany. One man's close working relationship is another man's bromance. Over in Ankara, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is counting on his strong personal affinity with his old new counterpart in Washington to trump, pun intended, any political risks that the latter's approach to foreign policy may entail. It's a gamble which could pay off, but it depends upon a political balancing act fraught with peril. Here's Dorian Jones reporting from Istanbul.
We're going to stop the invasion of our borders. We're going to reclaim our wealth. We're going to unlock the liquid gold that's right under our feet. Liquid gold.
Donald Trump is a man who acts with his instincts, and Erdogan is too.
Just one of the qualities he shares with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Hüseyin Barca, Professor of International Relations at Ankara's Middle East Technical University.
They are not intellectuals as we used to have political leaders after World War II. They are tradespeople, they are very pragmatic one, and they are political animals, if you want, in this sense, and transactional policies. They like not value-based policies. Quick actions, give and take is their character.
The respect between the two men appears to be mutual. Last month, when a rebel alliance toppled Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria, Trump was quick to credit Erdogan as the behind-the-scenes mastermind of the operation.
Turkey's the one behind it. He's a very smart guy. They've wanted it for thousands of years, and he got it. And those people that went in are controlled by Turkey. And that's okay. It's another way to fight.
But Syria could pose problems yet for the burgeoning Trump-Erdogan relationship. Top of Erdogan's political wish list from the incoming administration is likely to be the withdrawal of US forces, which are supporting the SDF, a coalition of Arab and Kurdish militias fighting the Islamic State. The main component of the SDF is the YPG, which Ankara designates as terrorists linked to a Kurdish insurgency inside Turkey. Trump, in his first presidency, promised to withdraw the forces. But in the last few weeks, the SDF leader, Muslim Abdi, has been warning of the danger posed by the resurgent Islamic State, aka ISIS or Daesh, following the collapse of the Assad regime.
The situation is very bad. Our security forces are in a very bad situation. We are in a very bad situation. Activity by Daesh has increased significantly, and the danger of a resurgence has doubled. They now have more capabilities and more opportunities. There is a real threat.
Trump's new administration is hearing such warnings about the threat posed by a resurgent Islamic State, or ISIS, claims Asla Aydintashbash of the Washington-based Brookings Institution. Aydintashbash warns that along with fears about ISIS, the ousting of the Assad regime and the uncertainty over Syria's new Hayat Tahrir al-Sham leadership makes any early US-Syrian pullout unlikely.
The chances of a speedy US pullout are significantly diminished, especially after what's just happened in Syria. I mean, you've had a group that had its origins in Al-Qaeda and ISIS, granted that they had shown a significant evolution, but a group with jihadist roots just take over Damascus, a country next to Israel. America is not going to pull out and lose all of its leverage.
Ankara's shared concerns with Washington over Iran's regional influence could give Erdogan and Trump an opportunity to work together, claims Mesut Jashan, a Turkish presidential advisor and professor of international relations at Istanbul's Yeditepe University.
And Iran is another headache for the Trump administration. If Mr. Trump aimed to be establishment, new solutions and methodologies with Iran, daytime U.S. needs the Turkish assistance and cooperation. When you're looking big picture, Turkey and also U.S. has to be come together.
Erdogan could well be looking to the Trump administration to lift a congressional embargo on fighter jet sales in exchange for any Iran cooperation. Given Erdogan's close ties with both countries, Ankara could also play a facilitating role in any Trump effort to end Russia's Ukraine war. Özgür Ünlü Husacıklı heads the German Marshall Fund office in Ankara.
If Trump is pushing for ceasefire in Ukraine, between Russia and Ukraine, Turkey could be very helpful as a potential mediator. So Turkey could be very helpful to the U.S. policy. Now, there are, of course, pitfalls. So what happens in Syria could be a test for the U.S.-Turkey relationship very early on in Trump's presidency. Turkey is actually preparing for a new intervention in northeast Syria against what Turkey sees as a terrorist organization and what the United States sees as a partner on the ground.
Trump, during his first presidency, crashed Turkey's currency after threatening to obliterate the Turkish economy over Erdogan's threats to attack US-backed Syrian Kurdish forces. Analysts warn that given the current weakness of the Turkish economy, Erdogan will have to tread carefully, whatever personal affinity he may feel for the president. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Tread softly because you tread on my dreams. This is Inside Europe and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. This is Inside Europe and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. coming up in the next half hour, a personal story of survival and friendship, 80 years after the liberation of Auschwitz.
Of course, my father saw me when I was a 13-year-old girl, and I came back as a 22-year-old adult woman, which was very hard to accept.
Finding empowerment and hope in the ranks of a UK climate choir, and what an epiphany, semi-naked Serbian men take the plunge. All will be explained, I promise. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Just days before the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp on the 27th of January 1945, the world watched as the richest and possibly most influential man on the planet, Elon Musk, gave a Nazi salute in front of the presidential seal of the United States of America. And yes, I'm going to say it was a Nazi salute. Here in Germany, we know one when we see one. Mr. Musk, however, is not who I want to talk about today. I want to talk about Alice Hubbers. In 1938, Alice Hubbers was a 13-year-old growing up in the flat above her parents' shop in Vienna and dreaming of becoming a beautician. But one day, while she was at school, her father was taken away to a concentration camp. Her mother would then make a decision which would change the course of her daughter's life. She sent her only child to Britain on a specially organised train journey called a Kindertransport, a scheme which rescued thousands of Jewish children from Nazi-controlled areas of Europe in the months before the war. And it was there, in the UK, that Alice's path crossed that of Michael Mitzman, father of our correspondent, Danny Mitzman.
I tell you what I remember about Dad.
I've brought my dad Michael for tea at Alice Hubbers' cosy flat on the outskirts of London. On the cusp of 100, she's baked Florentines and put out a terrific spread for us. It's the first time my dad's met her eldest son Julian and her daughter Caroline, who's visiting from Sydney.
Do you remember when Alice first came to live with you?
I can't remember her first introduction, but I do remember this rather much bigger than me, bossy girl coming along.
How old were you, Dad?
9, I think. She was very nice to me. Yeah, I had no complaints.
But how did an Austrian teenager come to be living with my dad's family in northwest London in the middle of World War II? To understand, we need to go back a few years to when Alice first arrived in England on a Kindertransport train. It was December 1938 and Alice was only 13. The Kindertransport was a British operation to rescue Jewish children from Nazi-controlled parts of Europe in the months before war was declared. Around 10,000 children were saved this way, but it was traumatic for them to be separated from their parents and sent to a foreign land.
I really felt very lonely. I mean, particularly first when I came here to England. My father was in a concentration camp, so I couldn't write to him anyway. So I wrote to my mum. Of course, he had no idea that I'd left the country.
Alice's parents both survived despite her father's year in Dachau and Buchenwald. Prior to the war, Jewish prisoners could secure release if they could prove they would emigrate, and Alice's mother had managed to buy them 2 tickets to sail to Shanghai. They couldn't return to Vienna until after the war.
I did not see them until 1947. Of course, my father saw me when I was a 13-year-old girl, and I came back as a 22-year-old adult woman, which was very hard to accept. And I made sure that when I was travelling that I was going to dress myself as young as possible, because, as I say, my father and my mother had not seen me as an adult, only as a young child.
Sadly, it was the last time she would see her already sick father. You could say in retrospect that Alice was one of the luckier ones. Many fellow Kindertransport children's parents and older siblings were murdered in the concentration camps. But Alice's teenage years, so far from her parents, were marked by an overwhelming sense of isolation.
I think I've got to hark back at the time before I was married, although I met people who were trying to be kind to me, you're still alone. I really felt very not wanted, an outsider.
Initially sent to stay with a non-Jewish family in Lincolnshire, she went on to spend 2 years at Whittingham Farm School in Scotland with other kinder transport refugee children. When she was 16, she moved to another home for Jewish refugees in the southwest of England.
I was sent to a place called Bydown, which was in Devon. It was an old manor house, and I wasn't there all that long because I hated it. And I'm very good at complaining.
Yes. I think that is a skill.
Well, yeah. The house was very, very old. There was no running water and certainly no electricity. And another thing I didn't like was that we had rats running around in the bedroom.
Despite the negatives, Bydown was where Alice first met my grandparents, Bessie and Morris Mitzman. British Jews of Polish origin, my father brought us up on tales of their wartime solidarity actions.
My father was very much involved in getting Jewish children in particular and their parents out of Central Europe and into a safe area, the safe area being Great Britain. And this in turn involved convincing the UK government that they would not be a drain on UK resources. The result was that it was necessary for each child or person who came to have an affidavit of support to prove that the money was there to support them for their initial stay until they were settled. And I'm not quite sure what happened after that.
I never met my grandfather, but I know he worked with various Jewish charities and organisations to raise funds, secure permanent residency and find work for refugees, or to help them get to Palestine. Part of his job was overseeing numerous temporary hostels and homes throughout the UK, one of which was Bydown.
One day I had to go to the manager for something, and Bessie and Morris were guests, nice people. Anyway, we had a nice chat, and I said, you know, any time you are in London, give us a ring, and, you know, maybe you'd like to come and have a meal with us.
New to London and miserable staying at a girls' hostel, Alice's complaining skills once again came in useful.
Because they knew I wasn't very happy at the hostel, they said, would I like to come and live with them? And that's how I came to live in Gordas Green with the Mitzmans.
My dad doesn't remember that much about Alice's 2 years with them, partly because she was at work as a seamstress in a fashion house in central London while he was at school all day and in bed by eight, partly because Michael, the 10-year-old boy, and Alice, the 18-year-old girl, had practically nothing in common, and partly because wartime memories tend to focus on other things.
I do remember that on a Friday, when my mother was frying fish, I used to stand in the garden and listen for the V1s. And as soon as I heard one coming, I would call her and she'd turn the gas down and we'd both go out into the shelter.
I remember when there was an air raid on, because they had this big grand piano. And when there was a real bad air raid, we used to crawl under the piano and hide under there, hoping nothing would happen. You know? So you were saying that the piano still exists?
The piano is at the moment being restored.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
This piano, between the two of them, they used to play Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto. I remember when I got married and his parents gave me away, I went from their house and there were flowers on the piano. I remember that.
So when you got married and you left from my grandparents' house?
Correct. Yeah, it was the most amazing day, actually, because they made such a fuss. It was quite amazing. All the family were there, and then all the neighbours who knew me. And Bessie had a waitress and things laid out, and drinks and canapes and whatnot. And I couldn't have expected anything more fantastic, seeing that, I mean, we're not related or anything, but it was just the goodness of their heart, and they wanted to give me a nice send-off, which was really just something. I kept friends with the Mitzma family, you know, for many years. I knew all the brothers, the sisters and sister-in-laws and the nieces and nephews, and, yeah, sort of like part of my family.
And, Dad, you never called Alice Alice?
Litzy.
Litzy.
Yes, Litzy. That was her, how she was known in Vienna.
I mean, all my family knew me as Litzy, but Alice stuck with me.
On my telephone, she's down as Litzy.
And my dad, you lost touch with for a while, and then you got back in touch with him later on, didn't you?
Well, the name Mitzman came up in conversation. Oh, well, you might know someone, you know, they used to live... That's right, well, you're talking about the people that I used to live with. Oh, yes, well, they had a son. I said, no, I remember they had a son. Oh, you remember that? Yeah, I remember that.
My dad often tells me one of the hardest things about getting old is losing so many of your contemporaries. So it's incredibly special, particularly for two only children, to be able to share memories of more than 80 years ago.
I remember that impressed me more than anything else, you coming and going in that blazer.
They're now both great-grandparents, but while my dad says his travelling days are over, Alice's daughter Caroline says her mum has no plans to stop.
We do a road trip every year whenever she pops over to Australia for her 3 months.
I like the pop-up.
Yeah, she comes for 3 months, she hangs out. My friends take her to get her nails done or goes for coffee or...
And she still does that now?
Well, I hope she's going to do it because she's getting on the plane on the 5th of February.
And age 100.
And we've got Pesach. She's going to be making gefilte fish balls as we do 100 gefilte fish balls for every year of her life. There's always something to do. So I put her on a camel when she was 92 in Broome. She went up in a little helicopter over the Pearl Farm, and we went on a three-wheeler Harley Davidson as well that year.
Alice's own mother lived to 101, and she's definitely inherited those genes. I asked her eldest son, Julian, to tell me the best and worst characteristics that keep his mum going strong.
I would say certainly her complaining is something that she's definitely cultivated throughout her life. She can be quite frustrating when she says that she can't do something when actually she can. But her best quality, I would say, is generosity. She's very open and accepting. And she's pretty good on her iPad, and despite all her resistance in sort of learning new technology, she's been very good. And that's kind of in a way kept her in touch with Caroline a lot, being able to communicate from here to Australia regularly. And, yeah, I see Mum fairly frequently.
He took me to the Festa Horta concert about 2 or 3 weeks ago, which was fantastic. It was my wish for my birthday, and he did. We heard Rachmaninoff and Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which was amazing.
She's very curious and interested and engaged, and so I think that's really been invaluable for her to stay connected and youthful, to be around young people and just always say yes to everything. Yep, as long as I can get in and out of the car, that's fine. As long as I've got something to wear. That's the most important thing. When I said, do you want to come to Australia? She said, I've just got nothing to wear. What am I going to... She doesn't want to miss out on anything, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Thank you.
I don't think it's quite as bad as your sister.
Thank you to our very own Danny Mitzman there for sharing the story of Alice Hubbers and her father, Michael Mitzman. Also, many, many happy returns to both Alice and Michael. Michael's 92nd birthday is on January 24th and Alice will be turning 100 on January 30th. So congratulations very much to both of them. Whilst we're marking anniversaries, this Friday is the 50th anniversary of Keith Jarrett's iconic Köln concert, the recording of which is the best-selling album in jazz history. The British pianist Dorian Ford will be giving his own spin on that anniversary at Cologne's Christuskirche on Friday. And earlier this week, I spoke via phone with someone who has complimentary tickets.
Wir saßen, mein Bruder und ich und unsere beiden Freundinnen, wir saßen in einem dieser...
That's Hein Hahn. In 1975, Hein was a 24-year-old student and keen music fan on a night out with his brother Klaus and their then girlfriends. The girlfriends didn't last, but the memory of that night has stayed with Hein and his brother ever since. From the very first note, they told me, they realised that they were experiencing something special. We'll be hearing more about the extraordinary story of how this historic concert almost didn't happen next week. But for now, if you go to this week's edition of Inside Europe on Spotify, you will find a list of events. Can you work out which ones also happened in 1975? There's a lot to choose from. Vietnam War ends, death of the Spanish dictator Franco, release of the movie Jaws, the Schengen Treaty is signed, Margaret Thatcher becomes UK Prime Minister, East Timor declares independence from Portugal. And I will give you a clue, most of these really are from 1975, but not all of them. Good luck. Now, time for something really fun. That is the sound of a Serbian man shivering in his swimming trunks after plunging into the near-freezing waters of the Vlasnia River in a moment now etched onto my brain, which was captured in a Stories from Europe video edited by my colleague Lavinia Pitu. And when I saw it, I had to invite her onto the programme to explain.
Hello, Kate. It's so nice to be here with you again. This always happens in January, which is winter in Europe. So basically, the swim symbolizes the baptism of Christ in the River Jordan. So a correspondent, her name is Jelena Djukic-Page, went to Vlasotnice, a small town in the south of Serbia, on January 19th to see it up close and to do a video report for us, of course. So basically, as you said, a priest throws this big wooden cross into a river and people will take a plunge and try to get it. And who gets it first wins. The symbolism revolves around sacrifice, purification, things like that. So, as I said, this takes place in mid-January. And I have to tell you that even a correspondent was freezing, although obviously she kept her clothes on. But
that's what she told you anyway.
Well, this is what I suppose and hope. Because she was there as a DW correspondent, so yeah.
I don't think DW is insured for reporters taking the plunge like that, actually, are they?
I have to do some research and find out. But yeah, imagine those people who put on swimsuits only and jumped into the river, which, by the way, on that day had a temperature of just 1 degree Celsius.
Oh my goodness.
1 degree.
Oh my goodness. I have to admit, when I was watching this video, I had to chuckle because our Balkans correspondent Guy Delorne took part in a edition of the program that we did where basically we set correspondents up with each other for a sort of speed date, right? And so in the context of the really informal conversation that he was having with, I think it was Danny Mitzman in Italy, he was asked something about, like, you know, weird quirks of the country that you report from. And the weird quirk that he kind of like picked up on was Serbian men and their absolute horror of getting their hair wet, which he says he finds really funny because they all have these really like buzz cuts, you know, like really almost shaved heads. And there were... All these shivering Serbian men with buzz cuts in this video, and I had to think of Guy.
Well, you know what, Kate? Several recent studies have shown that ice baths raise your dopamine levels. So, you know, probably in the end, all contestants there were frozen but ecstatic.
We should all be doing that. And it was for a good cause. It was for Epiphany, which confused me at first when you told me this, because for me, Epiphany is January 6th, but the Serbian Orthodox Church has a different calendar. How does that
work?
That's
right. It's on January 6th, but some Christian Orthodox communities, like the Serbian or the Russian one, still adhere to the Julian calendar, the so-called old calendar. And that's why they also celebrate the Epiphany on January 19th. So basically 13 days later. That's the explanation.
And you will find it alongside, I have to say, an incredibly eclectic collection of other stories as well. Maybe you could just quickly rattle off a list of some of the stories that you've covered in, let's say, the last fortnight.
So this week we had something about Bosnians being able to travel to Kosovo for the first time without a visa. We also had illegal landfills in Serbia.
You had a surfing granny from Greece.
Right. Thanks for reminding me.
I remember her.
This is an 86-year-old woman who still surfs and rides a motorbike and is super lively and interested in all kinds of adventures. And she's great, like 86. And she looks amazing, by the way, too.
Well, Lavinia, it is a punishing news cycle at the moment, but you have still managed to make a splash.
Thank you, dear Kate. That was fun.
Lovely. My colleague Lavinia Pitu from DW's Programmes for Europe department. You will find a link to that video in the show notes. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. As the USA pulls out of the Paris Climate Agreement, it is easy to feel despondent about our chances of tackling what is now clearly an escalating climate emergency. That's why I thought that we would end the programme by revisiting a piece first broadcast on Inside Europe last year. It was recorded in London by our usually Madrid-based correspondent Ashish Sharma at a rehearsal for the London Climate Choir movement. And honestly, if there was ever an advertisement for the idea that action generates hope, then it's these guys.
My name's Sally Davis, and I am one of the leaders of the London Climate Choir, which is just one of many climate choirs. I'm an instrumentalist too, so I've been playing in bands on processions for decades, sort of on piece demos, and instruments carry really well, but of course they don't have words. So the idea of large numbers of people singing in harmony really appeals to me.
One chance, only one chance.
My name is Kate Honey, and I'm one of the musical directors of the Climate Choir movement. I really care about the climate and the environment, so for me, the Climate Choir movement is the perfect way of combining those two things. And I love the fact that it feels like a very depolarizing thing to do at a time when, you know, social media and economic pressures are dividing us from each other. I feel this really unites us, and that's so important. It started with a friend of mine, a Quaker, Joe Flanagan, who heard some other singing protests in the US. And she said, wow, this is really making the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
Stop Rosebank, stop Rosebank, stop Rosebank.
But it was only actually at the beginning of this year, with a campaign against the expansion of Bristol Airport, that we decided to call it the Climate Choir Movement and actually make it into a real thing. And then we found that other choirs outside of Bristol, where it started, wanted to join in as well. And by the end of 2023, it was 10 choirs already. and just grew to about 550 singers, and now it's more like 600 singers and 11 choirs.
Stop Rosebank! Stop Rosebank! Stop Rosebank! Stop Rosebank! Stop Rosebank now!
Well, like many people, I have children, yeah? And what I'm concerned about what their lives are going to be like going forward. And we just have this limited period of time now to actually take action. We've all got a voice. We should be using it in the best way possible to communicate this message.
Great. And then we voice those sounds. We're going to do a long zzz and a long zzz and a long when we've infiltrated AGMs and that sort of thing. Some shareholders sit there looking astonished, embarrassed, really awkward. English people singing, yeah, it's a really embarrassing thing for English people. And they look kind of dumbfounded. But others turn around smiling and filming on their mobile phone. So it goes viral. And it's going to go, music is going to go, get out there, better than just people shouting.
I was at a kind of a local fete. It was in Highgate, as it happens, and they were singing there, and the harmonies cut through so beautifully. And I've been in the choir for 20 years myself. The climate is exceptionally close to my heart, simply because, I mean, it is for everyone in the way now, but because I'm a cyclist, and so you're always right there breathing in everything that is toxic, basically.
This is my first rehearsal at the choir. I'm a sort of failed Extinction Rebellion activist. I managed to turn up at the wrong places at the wrong times, and so I thought, well, perhaps I'll try something a bit more organised and see that I can manage that. I felt this might play to my strengths a bit. It aligns very much with my core beliefs. I think, you know, planetary climate change is something all of us should stand up, and I guess I'll be singing in public, not necessarily to a paying audience, which is what I'm used to, so I'm kind of interested in that experience too. That's what bearing witness is about, isn't it? You've got to stand up and say what you believe in at some point.
We focus on making really beautiful protest actions which kind of target the heart of power. That's what we aim for. In particular, the insurance companies and the banks that are financing the fossil fuel industry. When we say, you know, in a witty, beautiful way, just stop financing new oil and gas projects, actually they have had to change their tune. You know, recently Barclays announced they're not going to finance new oil and gas projects, which is an amazing win. We don't do illegal actions, we're a non-arrestable choir, but we do mass actions in the heart of London, trying to recruit over 100 singers to all sing the same songs together and focus on getting the money out of the fossil fuel industry.
There has definitely been a history of people rewriting the words of well-known tunes. It gets a bit hymn-like, so I'm quite keen on us writing. Hit you in the background there. You've got a bit of Handel's Alleluia chorus going on. So this is exactly what you're saying. It is words. It just changed the words. It's kind of amusing as well.
Stop Rosebank. Stop Rosebank. Stop Rosebank. Stop Rosebank.
Rosebank, by the way, is a major oil and gas field just west of the Scottish Shetland Islands. The London Climate Choir was recorded for us by Ashish Sharma in that piece, which first aired in March 2024. That's it for today. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Charlie Shield and sound engineers Jürgen Kuhn and Natalie Whitman. Our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. We love getting your emails, so please do use it if there's anything that you would like to ask, suggest, or just get off your chest. We'll be back next week. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.